Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, one problem spot to tell you about. It's on I-10 westbound. A crash blocks, or does not block, but it's on the exit ramp at 59th Avenue. Sunny skies in the valley forecast for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 109. Clear skies for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-80s. Chance of rain back in the forecast for tomorrow. 60% chance of rain tomorrow night with a high of 102. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 106 degrees. The Maricopa County Recorder's Office received some complaints last week after ASU students learned there will not be an on-campus polling location on Election Day. Elizabeth Bartholomew is with the Recorder's Office and says they were taking into consideration that most ASU students are not registered in the precinct where they attend school.
They're either on our permanent early voting list or they're registered, maybe still back at their parents' house. So they wouldn't even qualify to vote at that polling place on Election Day.
Bartholomew says instead they opened an early voting location in the ASU Tempe Campus Safety Escort Office. Students can vote there no matter which precinct they're registered in. It's one of 21 early voting locations open today through August 26th. The city of Buckeye says officials are now issuing single-family building permits at pre-recession levels. In June, they issued 166. That's the highest since June of 2008. Statewide, though, most cities and towns still have a way to go to reach those 2008 levels. Real estate expert Mike Orr says in Arizona, about 20,000 single-family permits will be issued this year.
Which is quite a lot higher than last year and almost double what it was 2 years ago, but it's still not back to the level of before the bubble when, at the height, we were doing 50 to 55,000 permits a year.
Orr says many areas are struggling to increase home construction rates thanks to a shortage of labor and affordable land. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody along with Phil Latzman.
And yes, the school year is upon us again in Arizona. And after the passage of Proposition 123 this spring, $3.5 billion in additional funding has begun to flow into classrooms around the state.
But is that money being used to address what's being called a critical shortage of teachers in the state?
Mark McCall is Deputy Associate Superintendent for Educator Excellence at the Arizona Department of Education, whose job it is to help recruit new teachers to the state. So, Mark, at this time last year, I spoke with your boss, Dr. Cecilia Johnson, who chairs the Department of Education's Retention and Recruitment Task Force. She told me about the critical shortages of teachers, particularly in Maricopa County. Is there still an educator deficit around the state?
We do still see a teacher shortage in not only Maricopa County, but across the state, although we don't have definite information from all of our districts yet. Our data reporting system, we give districts until around the end of September to share with us all of their hiring data. And so as schools are starting, districts are still filling those positions and reporting to us. So anecdotally, though, we've been hearing we know of a district here in Central Phoenix that has as little as four. And then a district over in the east side of Maricopa County has as many as 100. Mm. And then similar numbers kind of in that range across the state.
You're talking about vacancies?
Still in vacancies. Tucson schools, anywhere between 13 and 100, depending on where they are. And then we don't have any district information on our rural districts yet. We're still trying to gather that of like the reservations and our border districts and things.
Dr. Johnson, when we spoke last year, had said that one of the reasons for the shortages was that just simply wasn't enough money to pay teachers. Now, with the passage of Prop 123, has that helped the state and the individual districts recruit new teachers to come to Arizona?
That's a good question. The Education Retention and Recruitment Task Force actually just met last Monday, and we posed that question to several of the attendees who are all HR directors from various districts. And it's still too early for us to tell, because that money is just now flowing into the districts, it's too early for us to tell if their retention efforts and recruitment efforts have paid off because of 123. But we do know that the districts that responded to us said they were taking that money, and a lot of them were putting it into increased teacher salaries. So in that case, that can only help the profession, and they're doing it across the board. So a lot we're doing retention bonuses for folks who were signing contracts and deciding to stay in the district. And I think some were also doing signing bonuses for any new hires. So we don't know yet what the impact is, but it can't do anything but help.
And what's the kind of feedback that you're getting from teachers or when you go out on behalf of the state and try to recruit new teachers to come here? What's the reaction you get now? Has it improved any? Are people aware of the efforts have been made to try and improve teacher salaries here to get more teachers to come to the state?
I believe so. As I hear from some of my HR colleagues who are out and are going out to other states to do those recruitment efforts, that's of course being shared as a positive that we're doing what we can. We have voter initiatives that are going out there to improve the perception of the profession. So that's a positive. What we've got to work on is continuing to do that because our border states around us, particularly in Nevada, they're still producing salaries that are higher than what we have here. So we're having to look at folks who come to Arizona or even folks that are internal to Arizona who go to Arizona universities and then go out of state to teach because they could do better in California or Nevada.
Mark McCall is the Deputy Associate Superintendent for Educator Excellence at the Arizona Department of Education. Mark, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. One district that's bringing on some new teachers and giving educators a raise is the Phoenix Union High School District. Classes started there today. Craig Platenik is the district's communications director. And Craig, where are you right now as far as having enough teachers for the upcoming school year?
You know, I can't compare us with anybody else. We're probably about 25 teachers still short. We are going to have about 145 new teachers this year, and by new, they may be first-year teachers or they may be teachers who are coming from other districts or other states. So we're in pretty good shape, and generally what we try to do is if we are going to have some shortages, and we really don't know until the kids start coming, we like to reach out to our retired teachers and bring them in.
Of the new teachers, does that represent an increase in the pure number of teachers the district will have from last school year?
We're going to have a few new teachers, and part of the reason for that is we're opening two new schools. One brand new school is the Phoenix Coding Academy, and we've got six new teachers there. We're also going to be opening Linda Abril Educational Academy. It's a small alternative school that was called Suns Diamondbacks. They had a smaller staff, but they're going to expand their staff by a bit as well as we bring in more students to that school. Other than that, there isn't really a major increase other than increasing for student population, student enrollment.
Have you been using Prop 123 money to recruit some of those new teachers or give your existing teachers a little bit of a pay raise?
We don't really use them to recruit other than we're very fortunate in that we have among the highest paid teachers in the state. And this year, for the first time, a brand new teacher coming out of college or starting the profession for the first year, we finally hit the $40,000 mark. But definitely, most of the money from Prop 123 has gone to salaries, and obviously most of those go to teachers because that's our largest employee group. Our teachers are going to get a 1.5% increase on last year's salary. Some of our teachers who have been around for a while are also getting a step. It's a salary step on the salary schedule for 2013-2014, which was one of the years, one of a lot of years during the recession that they did not get raises. And then also every employee in the district is going to get a one-time 3% retention payment.
So I guess even if you're not actively using this Prop 123 money to recruit, the fact that you're giving these one-time increases and pay increases, step increases in some cases, I would imagine that is at least indirectly a kind of a recruiting tool.
Absolutely. And you know, we don't go around bragging that we have higher salaries than a lot of the other districts, but in fact, it's been amazing how many teachers that we have seen that have moved over from other districts in the Valley to come to our school district to teach.
Craig Platenik is the communications director for the Phoenix Union High School District. Craig, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Earlier this summer, Governor Doug Ducey signed an executive order banning state agencies and departments from hiring contract lobbyists. At the same time, he set up a system for those agencies to request an exemption from that order. One of those taking the governor up on that is the Citizens Clean Elections Commission, which argues the executive order doesn't actually apply to it. This comes on the heels of other disagreements between the commission and the executive branch. Jeremy Duda writes about this in the Arizona Capital Times. And Jeremy, are we heading for another showdown between the Clean Elections Commission and the Ducey administration?
It's certainly possible. I mean, both sides right now are kind of downplaying the possibility, at least to some degree. But that's kind of the logical conclusion of this. Of course, Governor Ducey in late June issued an executive order banning state entities from hiring contract lobbyists. And right now there is a dispute emerging over whether this executive order actually applies to them. The Clean Elections Commission often fends off attempts by legislative and executive branch to kind of curb some of the authority that it claims. Many Republicans believe they are very much overreaching on the authority they're granted by statute, and this is kind of spilling over into this lobbying ban.
Does this maybe seem like a bigger deal because of the past disputes between the Clean Elections Commission, which thinks it has certain powers, and other branches of government, which thinks it does not?
Well, I don't know if it's so much that it seems a bigger deal, that we have kind of a template for how these fights play out. And this is kind of the most recent incarnation of this. For most of this year, we've seen a fight over the governor's regulatory review council on kind of similar grounds, over the Secretary of State's office asked them to repeal some clean elections rules and regulations that apply to non-clean elections candidates and to independent expenditure committees. GERC has said, you guys need to repeal these rules. The commission said, hey, you don't have the authority to tell us to do that. The whole thing is kind of on hold right now. But this whole thing seems very similar in that it'll be a while before we see this fight peak. It's pretty early to say whether we're going to be going to court or something. But I think very much a possibility. As I mentioned, the Clean Elections Commission is applying for an exemption. The governor's executive order allows any entity that wants to keep its contract lobbyist to apply to the Department of Administration for an exemption. The Clean Elections Commission is doing that. If that were to be granted, then this whole fight gets, that kind of heads off this entire potential fight. If that does not happen, however, I have a hard time seeing the Clean Elections Commission saying, okay, well, I guess we'll just abide by this executive order, even though we don't believe this applies to us legally.
Have you gotten the sense that the Department of Administration and, by extension, the governor's office is interested in granting any exceptions to these agencies or departments or boards that would like to keep their contract lobbyists?
Well, the Ducey administration has informed the Department of Administration that they want the agency, they want Director Brown to be very sparing in these. Governor Ducey does not like these entities that are part of his administration having their own contract lobbyists. They do not really see much of a good reason for this to exist at all. And so they haven't spoken specifically about how they'll handle one agency's request or another. There are several that will be applying for them, but they've made it very clear they do not want very many of these added. And if anyone was going to get one of these, I can't imagine it's going to be Clean Elections. I mean, this fight that's been going on for years over them is a very much a philosophical dispute over this entity's role and the role of publicly funded campaigns. And Governor Ducey, as chief of staff, and his chief counsel up there on the ninth floor, they're all very philosophically opposed to not just kind of the clean election system in general, but very specifically some of the rules and regulations that they've been enforcing over the last few years, and which they send their lobbyists to the legislature to kind of try and fend off legislation ostensibly aimed at curbing that authority. So if anyone is going to get one of these exemptions, I would have a hard time seeing it be Clean Elections, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
That's Jeremy Duda with the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks as always.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
The pomp and ceremony, not to mention protests, of the opening ceremonies are over, and it's officially game on in Rio at the 2016 Olympics. BBC sports reporter Addie Doyden is there covering the games, and he joins me. So, Addie, what stood out to you so far?
In terms of action, obviously, Michael Phelps, brilliant. 19 gold medals, Olympic gold medals, you know, that's just a remarkable feat, really. And it's interesting listening to him at the press conferences. He says he feels like he's a different person. He seems like he's matured a lot. You know, he's a father now, and life has pretty much changed for him. He's going to renew his rivalry with Ryan Lochte this afternoon, which is going to be a mouth-watering showdown. So that's been very, very interesting. There have been a few shocks as well. Novak Djokovic, Grand Slam winner, beaten and knocked out early in the tournament. He was quite emotional afterwards. And I guess it shows you that, you know, we've had high-profile pullouts in the golf because of the Zika, in the NBA player, some of the big stars, LeBron James, haven't come here because of fatigue after a long season. But it shows that, you know, even with the likes of Novak Djokovic, you know, this Olympic tournament means a lot to him. And in terms of the city as well, I guess the other thing that's surprised me is that there's been a lot of talk about would Brazil be ready. And I must admit, when I got here, there were still some arenas where they were hammering the nails and getting things ready. But so far, everything is pretty much worked like clockwork.
Yeah, as you say, there was a lot of build-up to these games. You know, would the security be okay? Would the political situation be okay? Would the health situation be okay? And there was a lot of build-up, it seems, leading up to the opening ceremonies. But now that that is sort of behind us and the games themselves are underway, have things sort of settled into a familiar Olympic-type routine?
I think things are settling down. You know, I think people are still a bit jittery about security because it's a huge concern globally. I'm speaking to you from the International Broadcast Center, and on the way here, there are armed police all around the venue. So you do feel quite safe. You know, I've stayed here past midnight covering one or two events, and when I'm walking back to the accommodation where I'm staying, I certainly don't feel threatened. There is another Olympic Park where they host the weightlifting and the boxing. And again, when you leave there, I've been there late at night, you do feel quite safe because there's a heavy police presence here. But things are sort of settling down and you know, things are moving on. There have been one or two incidences. I don't know whether you heard, there was a controlled explosion near one of the venues in Copacabana Beach late last night. So generally, people are jittery, but things are generally just settling down and moving along.
When you say that people are jittery, does that include the athletes?
I think the athletes feel secure in the fact that there is a heavy presence, one in the athletes' village and around the venues. It's away from the venues, I think, is where people can get a bit concerned. There was a venue near Copacabana Beach. I heard that there were gunshots the other day. We don't actually know who was behind it or what happened. They found a bullet, you may have heard, in the equestrian venue. Again, they don't know exactly what happened there, but there was a press conference by the organizers who said there was nothing sinister. I think there was a police barracks not too far away from that venue, so that may be the cause of that. So I think by and large the athletes feel quite safe, and when you're in the Olympic venues you do feel quite safe. Is when you're away from that you do have to be vigilant. But then that's the same case if you're in any big city around the world.
One of the other concerns, and you referenced it going into these games, was Zika virus, and you mentioned that some of the top athletes decided not to go out of concern for that. Have you seen visitors, spectators, athletes taking any particular precaution against getting a bite from a mosquito?
Yeah, most people I've bumped into, whether it be journalists or international visitors, you know, you have some sort of mosquito spray, a DEET spray to prevent you being bitten. You know, I certainly carry one. We were all issued one when we came out here. And it hasn't really been a problem for me, if I'm completely honest. I haven't been bitten at all, and I haven't actually been aware. I know that some people, I'm on the 11th floor where I stay, whether that's too high for the mosquitoes to come and get me, I don't know. But I know some people have talked about there being mosquitoes in their rooms. But from a personal point of view, I haven't experienced it at all, but then I do lace myself with the DEET, and I have seen members of the public do the same as well. That hasn't been an issue as yet. I haven't heard any situations as regarding Zika or any concerns about that.
That was BBC sports reporter Addie Doyen in Rio. I'm Mark Brody, along with the Takeaway's John Hockenberry. And Addie talked about the excitement at the pool in Rio. It seems every 4 years, swimming becomes the American national pastime. Michael Phelps won his 19th gold medal last night. Katie Ledecky crushed her own record in the 400-meter freestyle. American swimmers have dominated the podium at the Olympics, winning three times as many medals as their closest competitor, Australia. That's curious for Americans who largely don't go near the water.
54% of Americans can't pass a simple swim test, according to the Red Cross. And the Centers for Disease Control warns that 10 people die from unintentional drowning every day in America. Terry Lachlan is a swim coach who developed the total immersion method of swim instruction. He's been coaching for more than 40 years. He's coached 24 national champions, both USA Swimming and NCAA, including two Olympic medalists. Welcome to The Takeaway, Terry.
Thank you, John.
So this isn't very much of an American pastime, yet you know, the Michael Phelpses of the world are you know, dominating.
Well, competitive swimming is a bubble, I lived in that bubble for quite a few years. I started swimming competitively myself in 1965 and then continued as a coach from 1972 through 1988. And it wasn't until I stopped being a swimming coach that I realized that I had been living in a bubble where everyone started swimming at 4 or 5, and the people who carried on to become competitive swimmers always learned faster and swam better than their peers. And that's even more true if you're good enough to swim in the Olympics.
So what explains the hesitance on the part of Americans to go in the water?
Well, it's their experiences. I would say it's a fair statement that for most people, their first attempt to swim a lap is a near-death experience. outside that bubble that I spoke of, virtually everyone experiences incredible struggle just to learn even the most basic skills and often outright defeat. And, you know, you said that only 54%, what was the statistic? 54% had basic skills or something like that?
Can't pass a swimming test by the
Can pass a swimming
right
test.
Cost,
yeah. Only 30% can swim the length of a 25-meter pool. And the American Swimming Coaches Association and the National Swim School Association have estimated that only 2% can swim a quarter mile nonstop, which is kind of the fundamental level of swimming in order to swim for fitness. And it's that distance that Katie Ledecky took 3 minutes and 56 seconds to swim last night. So it is extremely rare. Now, why? And I didn't discover this until I started total immersion and began working with what I call adult onset swimmers, people who only began swimming in midlife. And once I started working with them, I realized that virtually everyone I was working with was extremely anxious, that they were really uncomfortable in the water, and they responded to that anxiety with a lot of struggle. So they weren't really swimming, they were struggling.
And would you say that, you know, it's beyond simply hesitance that people are afraid of the water in America? Well, there's a culture of fear.
It's part of our basic primal survival instinct. You know, swimming is an aquatic skill, and we are terrestrial mammals, and we swim like it. If you think about what's in common, dogs, deer, and humans, we swim with the head up to avoid choking, and all our limbs going like crazy to avoid sinking. So it's all about avoidance, not about swimming with grace or ease or, God forbid, joy.
So all mammals are hesitant about swimming, and we're no different. But
We're very respectful of the water. You know, that there's been a fair bit said about running being a primal activity, and I would say swimming is just the absolute antithesis of that, or at least swimming well.
Well, you know, I've been to Australia. Are Australians a form of fish then? Because it seems like everybody swims in Australia.
I think the thing is that, and I've visited Australia a number of times, and I go to pools, and every pool has a teaching pool right next to it, and we don't see that here very often. So there's, I think, more of an emphasis on teaching, but I'm not sure they teach any better than we do. They just make better use of a smaller population, I suppose. But the form of teaching that's done here, the American Red Cross method, or the Amateur Swimming Association in England, or the ABC in Holland, everybody is teaching, basically trying to improve terrestrial technique. And so it focuses on the pull and the kick. I mean, anyone who's taken basic swimming lessons know that one of the first things they do is have you practice your kick, and they work on the pull. But propulsion or pulling and kicking is not the fundamental skill. It's dealing with that fear of choking and sinking.
Veteran swimming coach Terry Laughlin developed the total immersion method of swimming instruction. Thanks so much, Terry.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're talking to the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. In by 10, out by 4. That's the motto of many dry cleaners in the Valley. Maybe you bring your dress shirts or slacks to the cleaners before work and pick them up on your way home. But what goes on between those times? Today, we step into a day on the job at the dry cleaners.
My name is Elsa Sandoval. I'm a manager at the dry cleaners, and I make sure this place runs smooth. This is the production area. They make sure they separate every color. We do all the cleaning here for other stores, you know, besides this one. Sometimes there's stuff that needs to be pre-spotted like 3 times, so they have to go back inside the machine. The machine takes about an hour. You can actually, you know, dry clean everything. The only thing that we don't will be like undergarments. The person that dry cleans, what she does, she separates, you know, by color. So we don't never mix the dark with light, obviously, because the darker might bleed into a light. It looks like a washing machine, but we use, obviously, chemical and other solvents. And when it comes out, it's already dry. After we separate everything right here, mainly the two people in charge of assembling, which I'll be doing that today, they kind of control the flow. So they make sure that those clothes go in there in order by color. They separate everything. They, you know, move them to the rail, and then the girls, they, you know, start pressing. This is where we basically press pants right here. On this side, we press shirts, and then we push this all the way over here. See, right here, and it goes all the way around to the bagging area. And then we staple this invoice right here. You know what? I get bored doing the same thing. Give me something else, because it's, you know, I have to be like all over the place. So, you know, I have to be moving.
That's Elsa Sandoval dry cleaning garments in Tempe. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton wants to make in-state colleges and universities tuition-free for many students. She's proposing starting the program for students whose families make $85,000 a year or less, with the cap reaching those making $125,000 or less within 5 years. But how would that work, and what would it mean for those state schools? To help answer those questions, I'm joined by Scott Jasek, the editor of Inside Higher Ed. And Scott, are schools talking about how they'd need to adapt to this proposal should it take effect?
They're starting to, but a lot of people are very nervous because this is a dramatic change in the relationship of the federal government, state government, students, and universities. It would be many, many billions of dollars. And what she's proposing is a state-federal match. States would have to pay a share of this, and then the federal government would put money in to pay for it, and it would be free tuition up to families earning up to $125,000, which is most Americans. But it requires this infusion of federal and state funds to replace the tuition revenue that would be lost. Without that, I think most public universities would be against it, because a tuition freeze or reduction that doesn't replace the revenue could hurt the colleges.
What are states talking about? Because in a lot of states, including Arizona, higher ed has taken some pretty substantial financial spending cuts over the past several years.
Well, that's why some people view this as a necessary change. Particularly since 2008, but some ways going before, many states have abandoned their historic commitment to financing public higher education. And whether or not you think the Clinton plan is a good one, and there are lots of criticisms of it, I don't see another plan on the table right now to deal with the state disinvestment in public higher education.
Does Hillary Clinton's plan have any sense of where the federal money would come from to pay for this?
Well, she's talking about various tax increases that would not hit most Americans. I actually think if she wins, what will have to happen is a lot of dramatic change, and that may not happen. On the other hand, if she got 25% of what she's asking for, that could be a big deal.
In your mind, would that new funding model and payment model for higher education have any kind of policy impact? Would it change the way education is provided or delivered or who attends?
Absolutely, it might. If you look at the history of federal support for students to go to college, historically it has all been through aid to the students. This would focus this major new investment on public, largely on public higher education, which is a very different approach than we've seen in this country since World War II. Likewise, where the federal government goes, they quite likely will say, and we have some ideas about how you should do things.
I would think some universities would be fairly concerned about having the federal government more involved in sort of the day-to-day operations, though.
Many of them are. So private colleges, by and large, don't like this. Many flagship universities are somewhat skeptical. But again, if you're a flagship university, you can deal with some of your problems by enrolling a lot of out-of-state students, raising billions in private dollars. For a lot of other public higher education, there aren't good options. I mean, this plan would also adopt President Obama's proposal for free community college. People have a range of views on that. But in your state, when you look at the way the state walked away from paying anything to Maricopa Community College, to Pima Community College, none of this says that Obama's plan or Clinton's plan are perfect or even right, but there are very few experts I've talked to who think Arizona is getting it right today.
Is there a sense that if this plan or some version of it were to be implemented, public universities would put more of an emphasis on getting out-of-state and international students who would presumably have to pay maybe a little bit more to attend?
I'm not sure, because right now they're already doing that. That's how they're dealing with the fact that the states have walked away. But certainly that would be one possibility. On the other hand, they might have more of an incentive to enroll. Students would have more of an incentive to stay in state but to get the free education.
Scott Jasik is editor of Inside Higher Ed. We were talking about Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton's proposal to allow for some students to attend in-state college tuition-free. Every 2 years before the primary elections for our state legislators, the Arizona Charter Schools Association sends out a survey to every candidate, asking them about their support for public education, education funding, and school choice. This year's survey results are out, and the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with Eileen Sigmund, the president of the Charter Schools Association, about this. And Lauren, what did they find?
Well, first and foremost, they found that nearly 9 in 10 of the candidates who responded said they rank K-12 education as their first or second priority. They also found 83% of candidates believe that parents should be able to choose what school is best for their children, and 75% support the concept of public charter schools. So Sigmund said it all surrounds the issue of school choice.
Arizona has one of the largest charter movements in the country. We lead the nation in the percentage of charter schools and students. And we found there is broad-based support for school choice in Arizona and charter schools.
And they also found 75% of candidates who responded to their survey said charter schools and district schools should be funded on an equitable basis.
And of course, this is all in light of the battle over education funding that's really been going on for years now.
Exactly. The legislature sets the state's budget, including for education, and Sigmund said with the passage of Prop 123, they gave schools a nice boost, but they want to make sure that students are funded equitably by the legislature, whether they go to a district school or to a charter school.
It's not that we want to be funded the same as districts. What we'd really like to do is look at what our students' needs are and come to funding based on our 1.1 million public students that we have. And that's where we're looking at it. Don't base it on a system, base it on a student's needs. So, for example, student who may have special ed, no matter what school that child goes to, that child would have the same services of funding that wherever they are at school.
And do you think that the funding that our state is providing our public school students right now is adequate?
I don't think anybody would agree that in Arizona that we are meeting the resources that are required in our public education. However, we also have to look at the totality of what is going on.
So tell me a little bit more about that. Like, what are you advocating for in terms of funding education equally, like you said, and also for the system as a whole?
There is Classrooms First, which Governor Ducey is tasked with overhauling K-12 finance. And what we'd like it to do is to be equitable for our students, transparent, and we have none of that going on. So we want to have stable, predictable funding so our schools can plan on growth. We have, in the charter sector, we are the growth sector of public education. And in order to plan for growth, you need to know that there's some stability in funding. Prop 123 was a huge help, so we're taking the right steps, but there's still a lot of uncertainty, which is impeding growth.
So things seem to still be pretty uncertain in terms of where the funding is going to be and how it's going to change. What do you hope that looks like?
Well, I mean, in the charter sector, as we head into the next legislative cycle, our expanding excellent schools are facing a huge cut, and we need to get some certainty in the funding for our schools before they're going to open their doors to more students. And with huge waiting lists, we want our schools to be able to open their doors for more students.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with Eileen Sigmund, president of the Arizona Charter Schools Association. 49 states plus D.C. have restrictions in place for new drivers who are behind the wheel at night. But new research from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows those restrictions may not be as effective as they could be based on when they start. In Arizona, for example, more than half of the fatal night crashes happen before the state's restrictions take effect at midnight. For more on this, I'm joined by Dr. Ruth Schultz, senior epidemiologist in the Division of Unintentional Injury Prevention at the CDC. And Ruth, what do you make of these results?
So what we did was look at when during the day that 16 and 17-year-olds tend to drive, and then we sort of lined that up with how states address nighttime crash risk with nighttime driving restrictions. And what we found is that for these newly licensed drivers, 16 and 17-year-olds, they do most of their driving during the daytime hours, but nearly a third of the fatal crashes they're involved in happen at night.
So given those results, do you consider graduated driver's license laws sort of an idea that's good in theory but maybe doesn't do as much as supporters say it does in practice?
Well, graduated driver licensing laws have come into effect in really every state now since the 1990s, and evaluations have shown that they're extremely effective. We've seen dramatic declines in fatal crashes involving these newly licensed drivers. In fact, their fatal crash involvement has dropped by about 50% in the last decade. So, and graduated driver licensing is largely seen as contributing greatly to that decline. We were looking at a specific component in graduated driver licensing, the nighttime driving restriction. We know that driving in the dark is challenging for any driver, but it's especially challenging for young drivers because they don't have experience driving at night. Every state but Vermont now has a nighttime driving restriction, but in 23 states, the restriction doesn't start until midnight or after. And what we found is that few young drivers, 16 and 17 years old, are out on the road at midnight or after. And so those restrictions that start that late provide less protection than restrictions that started earlier hours, say 9 or 10 o'clock.
Yeah, in Arizona, for example, the restriction starts at midnight, and what you found was that more than half, 56% of the drivers in night fatal crashes happened before midnight, so before the restriction went into effect. In your mind, is the answer something as simple as making the restriction start earlier?
Evaluations have shown that restrictions that started earlier hours do save more lives. And so the recommendations from the research community is that the restrictions start earlier. There's often then concern about young people who may work or they may be involved in school activities that require them to maybe drive home after 9 o'clock, say. And in those cases, legislatures are free to put in exemptions to cover those specific types of situations.
In your mind, does a one-size-fits-all approach work here? And I think that in a place like Arizona, for example, where in some parts of the summer it can be pretty light still until, you know, 8:30, nearly 9 o'clock at night. So it's almost not even like you're driving at night at 9 o'clock because it's still fairly light out. How much of sort of those local kinds of things, those unique things to each individual state, do you think lawmakers need to be taking into effect and traffic safety experts need to be taking into consideration?
Well, that's a good point. And graduated driver licensing systems are put into place by state legislatures. And every state has their own considerations to make. Certainly, the driving experience of young people who grow up in rural areas is very different from that of young people who grow up in cities. And so there are considerations to be made. And we need to think both about mobility for young people and also for their safety.
Dr. Ruth Schultz is a senior epidemiologist in the Division of Unintentional Injury Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Ruth, thank you very much.
Sure. My pleasure.
There is a shortage of private pilots around the country and around the state, and an Arizona group is trying to increase the ranks. Mark Spencer is vice president of the Arizona Pilots Association. And Mark, first off, what is the state now of the private aviation industry?
The overall numbers, no one would argue, are in a long-term decline. However, they have stabilized in the last few years, which is a good thing.
Why is it that there are fewer pilots in the private aviation industry these days?
Well, in the general aviation, and in class what we call private pilot, license numbers have actually dropped by about 51%. But a good part of that, we believe, actually moved up in their status into, you know, air transport pilots and those sorts of things. And that's indicated by the fact that ATP pilots have increased 120%. So, yes, we're losing private pilots, but many of them are moving on to careers in aviation, which is a positive. Nevertheless, there's a big glut, sort of in the middle age. Right now, the highest number of pilots, believe it or not, are in the, I don't want to call it the elder years, but in the 50 to 64 year range. And then the second largest pilot group, private pilot group, is down in the 20 to 35 year range. Pilots drop out between those two age groups. We think it's because they're having children, you know, growing families, things like that. Aviation can be expensive, although it doesn't have to be. And I think that right there, the perception of the cost of flying, is one of the reasons we don't attract as many new pilots as we would hope.
What does this drop in private aviation mean? Like, what are some of the practical impacts, things that maybe had been happening before that are either not happening or not happening now with the same frequency as they were before?
Well, that's easy. Smaller airports, the smaller communities and stuff, their airports are struggling. Where there used to be what we call fixed bases of operation, in other words, small businesses that provide fuel and services at these small airports, sometimes a mom-and-pop restaurant on the airport, a lot of those have closed and or are struggling without the GA population growing.
There's also been some talk about the impact that this slowdown might have on getting needed supplies to places where it's not the easiest place in the world to get to. Has that sort of thing been affected as well?
Somewhat, yes. You know, if the small airport closes, you know, that takes away the advantage of being able to get supplies into that place easily with aviation. One of the advantages of general aviation is the fact that it's time efficient. Some of the places that it takes many, many hours to drive to in Arizona in an automobile, you can reach in an aircraft in under an hour. If we lose the airport there because of lack of activity and funding, obviously we've lost an opportunity for, you know, time efficient access to those communities.
So what are groups like yours trying to do to get more people involved? I assume you're looking for younger people, maybe in that age range before they start having families and dropping out, because I would imagine that you'd like to boost those numbers up a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. And we work hand-in-hand with one organization in particular called the Experimental Aircraft Association, EAA. EAA has a program called Young Eagles. For example, down in a community I'm familiar with in Sierra Vista, once a year, the EAA chapter there, along with other organizations such as ours, would gather together and hold an event, a Young Eagles event. And, you know, they'll fly 200 to 300 students from the local schools over a two-day period, take them up for a 15-20-minute flight, introduce them to aviation, and try to encourage them in becoming interested in aviation.
Mark Spencer is Vice President of the Arizona Pilots Association. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Our relationship with the telephone is changing quickly. There are now more cell phones than people in the U.S., and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say nearly half of homes don't even have a landline. As we race toward an all-digital, all-wireless future, there's still one place in Phoenix that celebrates old-school telephonic technology. KJZZ's Stina C. takes us there.
At the Pioneer Telephone Museum, you don't just read about history, you hear it. Like the ring of an old trimline phone. Or the clatter of a teletype, a message-sending machine that eventually replaced Morse code. But the best vintage sound in the place has got to be tour guide Joe Hersey.
We can only blame ourselves for all the crime and violence today. We removed all the phone booths, and now Superman has nowhere to change.
That poem sits in one of the museum's many glass cases. Historical photos are all around, and so are rotary phones and a full-scale switchboard, the kind you see in black and white movies. Hersey says this is all about celebrating the vision that began when Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone in 1876.
From the simple fact of trying to put voice on a wire to being able to carry around a phone in your pocket and a thing stuck in your ear or a Bluetooth, and, you know, you're communicating with the world.
Hersey had a hand in that. The 81-year-old is still a proud Bellhead who began working at the Bell Telephone Company more than 60 years ago. Eventually, the federal government busted Bell up, but that didn't break the telephone pioneers who began this museum and a few like it across the country. The national organization is made up of telephone employees, past and present, Hersey included. There's just one problem.
There's not many of us left.
At least not in Arizona, where Hersey estimates only a few hundred active members remain. The group, often simply called Pioneers now, still has about 500,000 members in the U.S. and Canada, and they still do the kind of charity work pioneers have done for generations, like building parks and making baseballs that beep for blind people. But like a lot of service organizations these days, they're having to remake themselves to appeal to one important demographic. The people who might not recognize that sound of a coin plunking into a phone booth. Young people. Even the Pioneer Telephone Museum can be a tough sell for the younger crowd.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
But not for 86-year-old Coralie Yeager, smiling at a shelf of novelty phones shaped like a pickle, Garfield, and a Volkswagen bus.
Girls, French fries? Is that a telephone, the French fries?
Yeager is here with a church group of delighted-looking retirees. They aren't here to be introduced to the old days, but to relive them. When I tell Yeager that some young folks might not be as enraptured by all this, she's incredulous.
Why would they say it's boring? It's absolutely exciting. I mean, think where we're going to be 20 years from now.
Joe Hersey has a theory about that.
I personally think they'll inject a chip in you and you click your teeth and Google will appear in your eyeballs.
As for the future of this local chapter of the Pioneers, Hersey is less sure. CenturyLink has pulled its funding for the group, so this museum must move from the company's building. I asked Hersey if that's proof of how much the country has changed from the days when the Bell Telephone Company was king. That might be true, Hersey says, but he's at peace with it.
You know, they got rid of the gladiators. They got rid of the knights.
In other words, you can't fight progress.
That's history.
And come this fall, all that telephone history that Hersey so loves will have a new home. The Pioneer Living History Museum north of town. Whether or not Hersey will be leading tours remains to be seen. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.